I'm John Livernois, Interim Vice President of Research, and it's a pleasure to welcome you here today to our University of Guelph's very first Royal Society of Canada Romanowski Lecture. You may be aware, or you may not be aware, that today is the International Day for the Preservation of the Ozone Layer. September 16 was named in 1994 as part of the Montreal Protocol as that day. And the Ozone Secretariat of the United Nations Environment Program asks everyone in the world to celebrate this day. So I think this is a very appropriate way to celebrate the International Day of Preservation of the Ozone Layer, to have a renowned ecotoxicologist scholar speaking at the University of Guelph. I'd like to thank the Royal Society of Canada for sponsoring this lecture. And by the way, just mention that we have two inductees announced today into the New Scholars College of the Royal Society of Canada. That's a new, there's a fly here, it's not me just, it's a new a new category of the Royal Society of Canada. So we have Ryan Norris and Evan Fraser inducted, and that's a real accomplishment for them, and of course, it does us all proud as well. Congratulations to them. And again, thanks to the Royal Society of Canada. Representing the Royal Society of Canada today, and to introduce our speaker, is our own Professor Emeritus, Dr. Peter Kevin. And I'd like to invite Dr. Kevin to come to the microphone and introduce our speaker. Peter.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, and it is with pride that we can say the University of Guelph has two new members of the new college. It's a new initiative on the part of the Royal Society. So I bring greetings from the Royal Society of Canada, and particularly President Graham Bell of McGill University, who's not able to be with us today, and also on behalf of the 2,000 fellows of the Royal Society. And it really is a delight to be able to introduce the first of this year's Romanowski Lecture Series. The University of Guelph and the Royal Society of Canada have a long and rich history of collaboration, and certainly I'm hoping that that will increase in the future. So it's no surprise that we look forward to continuing to build on this relationship and events such as we have today, and to recognize and promote outstanding work of our fellows. The Royal Society of Canada was founded in 1882 under an Act of Parliament and charged with pursuing three missions. First, to acknowledge and recognize scholarly achievements in all fields of research and in the arts. And second, to provide expertise and advice to government and to Canadians so as to foster an environment of well-informed, fact-based public policymaking. This is a particularly onerous task these days. And third, to promote culture of knowledge and innovation in Canada. And that brings us to the Romanowski Lecture Series. Now, Miroslav Romanowski was a meteorologist. This lecture series was founded in 2002 as a vehicle to feature winners of the Miroslav Romanowski Medal, and there's a picture of the medal here and a little bit about it. And the nomination for this medal is based on research that has resulted in significant contributions to the resolution of scientific aspects of environmental problems, and that's what Dr. Giese is going to tell us about. Before we get started, though, I want to introduce Dr. Giese, your lecturer for today. He is one of the world-leading ecotoxicologists and an environmental chemist with interest in many aspects of ecotoxicology, as I'm sure most of you know, including both fates and effects of potentially toxic compounds. His studies span the scale from laboratory to field, so not just a lab tech type of person, but also a field investigator, as well as mesocosm studies and extended to global concerns, and that's what we'll hear about today, I'm sure. He has applied tools from traditional to molecular biology at each level of his research. He is a discoverer of the phenomenon of photo-enhanced toxicity of organic compounds such as PAHs. He is the first to report on the occurrence of perfluorinated hydrocarbon compounds in the environment, and that's the story he's going to tell us today. Dr. Gizzi is the recipient of many awards. He's published nearly 1,000 scientific papers and reviewed works, and is among the most cited author, perhaps the most cited author in the world of combined fields of ecology and environmental sciences. Throughout his career, he had a long and strong affiliations with the University of Guelph. There were numerous exchanges between Guelph and Michigan State University when he was there, and they were manifest through the fiercely competitive but very friendly interactions between the graduate students in the mini symposium that took place over a period of 2 decades, from about 1987 to 2006. And when John moved to Saskatoon, the distance was too great, so we weren't able to take busloads of students there. And I'm sure they did all sorts of things, including duty-free shopping, as they were going back and forth across the border. So Dr. Gizzi is no stranger to us. And I'm sure he's taking, and I know he is from this morning, advantage of his time here to renew his friendships and catch up on recent advances on the University of Guelph campus, and vice versa. So nothing I'm saying to you will be a surprise to you once you've heard his talk. Would you please join me in welcoming Dr. Gizzi to Guelph again to deliver the first of the lectures in the 2014 Royal Society Canada Miroslav Romanovsky lecture. He's going to talk to us on the toxicological evaluation of perfluorooctanes in the environment, anatomy of an environmental issue. These compounds, the perfluorooctanes, are not as inert as we might have originally expected them to have been when they were first brought onto the market in the 1940s, I believe. So John.
Maybe I should sit down. I was talking to Keith earlier, Keith Solomon, about lecturing in China for 8 hours in a day, and I said, sometimes I sit down, but I won't. So, as indicated, we do research in the lab, in the field, really all around the world, Arctic, Antarctic, tropics, you name it. A lot of my work revolves around birds, which will be a key in this lecture today. That was all mentioned. We're going to talk about just one thing, perfluorinated chemicals. So I could never decide whether I like chemistry or biology both, so I was a dual major and continue to do that today, which is a theme of what I think is important in our field of environmental toxicology, to be able to communicate and work in teams. Because this is a story that really took the chemistry and the biology. We have a student-based research program. We try to work on what we call socially relevant issues. We like to try to solve problems if we can. When people ask me what I do, I tell them it's basically environmental forensics. It's CSI without the body. So when they're always saying, put it in the mass spectrometer, well, that's what I do. Or when they say, let's get the DNA, well, that's what we do. So we do both molecular biology and environmental chemistry. Where I do it is at the University of Saskatchewan. Here's a picture of our institute. On the back is a wing that they built for my group when I went to the U of S. So U of S has been a great home for us, though I don't live there in the winter, as you'll probably understand. It's why it's a great home. But we have world-class facilities. We probably have the best aquatic toxicology facility in North America. So we're very pleased with that, and it really facilitates what we can do. So a few quick observations. Chemists define what they look for. Things are not always as they seem. You should always question dogma. Be careful of trace contaminants in your standards. My career has been spent correcting other people's mistakes where they made wrong conclusions because their standards were contaminated. Natural is not always without effects. There are a lot of really toxic chemicals that are not synthetic. And simply because it's synthetic doesn't always mean that it's a problem. So for the students in the audience, I would just say, you know, never stop asking why, what if, and who cares. And that will really be what we'll talk about today. And Hillary Clinton has said it takes a village to raise a child, and to me that means it takes a team approach. So what I'm going to speak about today includes work from many, many of my students and grad students over a long period of time. And I really can't mention all of them individually. So many discoveries are serendipitous, and that is the case with this particular discovery. And discoveries come when you have a flexible mind and you're willing to say, that's interesting. Let's try to find out what caused that or why it occurred. And I believe that these discoveries are made on what I call the margins of disciplines, where there's overlap, where you have a nutty person like me who works in chemistry and biology and can bring groups together who are experts in both those fields to get the answers that we need. So we've got risk benefits. Energy, particularly fossil fuel, has allowed us to do a lot of the things that we do, including the chemistry that's improved a lot of our lives, and the freedom to do things like study. 100 years ago, most of us would have been on the farm and not being educated at university and not have the time to endeavor in research like we have now. So our lifespan has been improved, a lot of it through chemistry. We have a lot of things that we use in our daily lives, none of which would have been available without chemistry. Lifespans have increased greatly, in part due to chemical advancements. So, but with chemistry comes this Janus effect, the good and the bad, the benefit and the risk, the good and the evil. I spent a lot of time in China, so for me it's the yin and the yang. It's this idea of the balance. Historically, some examples of DDT, you've all heard about, the villain DDT, was, at the time it was invented, a miracle chemical, a wonder chemical that saved millions of lives around the world and continues to do so to this day. And Paul Mueller, the inventor of DDT, received the Nobel Prize for this. But later we found out that it does persist in the environment, it's accumulated into animals and can cause effects. PCBs were invented so you didn't burn down your house. In the old days, transformers had mineral oil in them, and if they were hit by lightning, they would burst into flame and burn down your house. Chlorofluorocarbons were invented so your refrigerator wouldn't kill you in the night. When I was a boy, when we first got electricity in 1957, my mother bought a refrigerator, but she left it on the back porch. And the reason was your refrigerator used ammonia in those days as a coolant, and it could leak in the night and kill you. So those fluorochlorochemicals that we'll talk a little bit about today were invented to be safer. And the perfluorinated chemicals that we'll specifically talk about today were incredibly useful. So this is the chemical that I want to talk about today. I'm going to tell a story. I'm not going to give a lot of technical information. For those interested in the more specific technical information, you can write to me, I'll send you a list of papers, and also I'll leave the lecture here with some information. But the key thing about this molecule is it's very persistent. It does not degrade in the environment. In fact, it's part of other chemicals that do degrade, but this is the terminal degradation product. And it's the chlorine carbon, or the fluorine carbon bond is very strong. Can't be broken by sunlight, or you can boil it in sulfuric acid. You cannot break this chemical down. That's because it's not found naturally, and it's made by electrochemical. So we put a lot of electricity, a lot of energy into making the chemical, and that makes a very, very stable product. And it has a lot of very interesting properties. It's amphiphilic, which means it repels water and oil. So it's very good in treating textiles, carpeting, paint, a lot of other things. But it is analogous to a fatty acid. So when it enters the body, your body thinks it's a fatty acid, but it cannot be metabolized because it's so persistent. And so this can lead to some potential problems. So lots of products. Pop culture in Canada as we know it would cease if we didn't have popcorn, right? But these chemicals were used as sizing. And so it got into food. So it was in the containers that you were eating, and once through metabolism, that chemical would get degraded to the end product, PFOS, or PFOS. It was in Scotchgard. And this is a list of all the uses, and there are very many of these. But two of the most important ones are carpeting, where about 70% of this product was used to treat carpet with things called Scotchgard. And it was used and is indispensable in making microchips. So imagine the world without your cell phone. And if we don't have these chemicals or things that could replace them, you can't make microchips. So these will play into the story. I've just put some properties up here. For those that are interested, you can look at the numbers. But I'll tell you the most important things. The chemical is very soluble in water. It's not very volatile in the air. And it behaves fundamentally differently than all of the chlorinated hydrocarbons that we know so much about. So over the years, we've learned a lot about how chlorinated hydrocarbons work, and we understand how they move in the environment and what effects they can have. These chemicals do not partition into fat, so they don't biomagnify the way pesticides that are organochlorines have done in the past, and they bind to protein. So they're a fundamentally different animal. When we try to do an assessment about their fate and effects in the environment, they're very, very different. There's not much we can take away from organochlorines to help us understand these chemicals. As I told you, they're very, very persistent in the environment. They don't break down. They're thermally stable. You can't, even at high temperature, destroy them. They don't break down by sunlight, photolysis. They don't get microbially degraded. So they stay a long time in the environment. And their partitioning is very different than organochlorines. They tend to stay in water, and they don't bind or accumulate in fat, like a lot of these other chemicals do. So their bioconcentration factor is pretty low. DDT, it's about 35 million. On this chemical, it's about 500. So it doesn't tend to get bioaccumulated as much. And just some comparisons with chemicals like DDT or PCBs. And you can see the water solubility is much greater. That means it stays in the water and it doesn't tend to get pushed into animals. And even though it has a similar molecular weight, very, very, very different environmental properties. So it's a different beast. So how did the story get started? In a little bit, I'll walk you through a timeline of what happened in the discovery process and some of the socioeconomic issues. But basically, the way most of it got into the environment was it was put into products, into polymers, particularly into polymers used to make textiles and particularly carpets. So what you can see here is a chemical, and here's the PFOS tail right here. This is the chemical that we found in the environment. And it's bound to a number of other chemicals that are actually intercalated into the polymer. So one of the first key things here is because it's in a polymer, it came under, in the United States, something called the Polymer Exclusion Clause under the Toxic Substances Control Act, which basically said if it's a polymer, you do not have to do any toxicity testing. So very little was known about this chemical. And second of all, since you don't have to monitor it, there were no analytical techniques to measure it in the environment. So what happened was about 8% of this material was not intercalated into the polymer, and it could be released into the environment where it would ultimately degrade to PFOS. And it moved around the globe. So the original chemical that was released was an alcohol, and like methylfos alcohol, has a very high vapor pressure, and it can move on the wind. So it would move all around the world. And then once it was degraded, either microbially or by people, to that final termination product that couldn't be degraded anymore, it would stay there. So as you'll see in a minute, we could find this in polar bears in the Arctic, penguins in the Antarctic, many places where they didn't have any carpets. So this is the basic mechanism, probably maybe up to as much as 8% in some products, but a small amount. But the problem is massive amounts of this chemical were being made. So 1% of a very large amount resulted in a significant amount of contamination in the environment. So it's ubiquitous. We've found it everywhere we've looked. It accumulates into people. All of you have some PFAS in you. Professor Solomon would be glad to test your blood, tell you how much PFAS you have in you. But if you ate popcorn, for sure, you've got a lot. It can be toxic, and this was not thought to be the case. As Peter pointed out, it was thought to be very recalcitrant and inactive, not reactive with biological systems, therefore not toxic. So nobody was really looking for or into this chemical. Basically no reason to. So why do a risk assessment? Well, the story is, once we found it in the environment, we didn't have any of this information. So we were interested to effects of most sensitive species at the top or bottom of the food chain, and we didn't have answers to any of these questions. How to be able to predict how much was going to be in one species or another, how toxic it was going to be. We really had absolutely no information. We certainly didn't have any dose-response relationships or know anything about what were the uncertainty factors that we would need to consider in doing a risk assessment. And these things occur in complex mixtures with other chemicals. So really, some of the issues revolve around another chemical, PFOA, that we now know is also in the environment. And there are about 60 of these chemicals that are perfluorinated analogs that are in the environment. And in currently in Canada, 87 chemicals are banned. Some of those degrade to other things, so there's a few more of them. So what we didn't know how to do was how to treat these mixtures. Is it independent toxicity? Is it additive? Is it joint additive? We didn't have any QSAR predictions for toxicity or bioaccumulation because it's so different. We couldn't rely on what we knew about PCBs or DDT. So we really kind of knew nothing. And if we wanted to look in the environment, we didn't know what species we should monitor, what ages, what gender. We didn't know any biomarkers that we could look for to see if animals were being affected or not. So we really had a complete paucity of information. So I told you about this polymer exclusion policy that meant nobody was working on these chemicals. And I told you that they had very different products. And these were very, very unique. And in particular, we had no methods to identify them in the environment. And no information on toxicity. So what needed to be done was to develop and validate analytical methods, conduct a global survey, determine critical mechanism of toxic action, conduct a global risk assessment, and present information to regulators. And we did this all in 1 year. From the time we discovered this, we were able to do all of these things. And within 2 weeks of the time that we released the information, the chemical was jointly withdrawn by EPA and 3M company that was making most of this. 2 weeks after we made our discoveries known to the regulators. So it happened. It took 12 years to ban DDT after it was found to be a human carcinogen. So it happened very, very quickly. So real quickly on the analytical methods, this fluorine carbon bond is very strong, about 110 kilocalories per mole. One of the things that we can do is look at inorganic and organic fluorine, but PFAS is not volatile, so we can't use gas liquid chromatography, which is our standard way of looking at pesticides, PCBs, other things. We could do derivatization followed by gas chromatography, but that resulted in fairly poor results, so that wasn't very useful. And because the leaving groups that are formed are very, very unstable, so they would degrade actually in the injector of the instrument. So we couldn't really use any of those techniques. High-pressure liquid chromatography is good to separate them, but they don't contain any chromophores. That means there's no way to detect them with a UV or visible detector like we would for proteins or other things. We could use fluorescence detection, but the sensitivity was very, very poor, so that wasn't very useful. 19F neutron magnetic resonance measurements had been used for other fluorochemicals, but it's not sufficiently sensitive and requires some pre-concentration. So what to do? So what we came up with was something called ion pairing, so we could separate by HPLC, and then we were able to quantify by something called negative ion electrospray tandem mass spectrometry. So what made all this possible was the invention of an analytical technique, negative ionization electrospray with what's called a triple quadrupole tandem mass spectrometer, which basically means we've got three mass spectrometers hooked together. And until that technique became available, we wouldn't have been able to do this analysis. So we bought one of these instruments, and the first one we had was very expensive, and it was what's called a unit mass instrument. What that meant was I could resolve one atomic mass unit. So I could tell 599 from 598. We just bought this year, with your tax dollars, thank you all very much, a new ultra-high resolution LC-MS. That instrument gives me resolution of over 500,000. So I can tell the difference between two molecules that are as different as 0.000001 AMUs. So from the time we did this work until we were where we are today, and that instrument cost us $850,000. So you don't just go buy these all the time. But here's basically a picture. So we've got all these mass spectrometers lined up. If you look in the lab, we've got junk all over the place, machines hooked to other machines. But basically, what we were able to do is atomize this material and get it through a mass spectrometer. And by using what we call transition atoms, I was able to accurately analyze for these chemicals. It turns out that if you use just plain mass spectrometry, there's a bile acid in human blood that will come out at the same mass, and you would identify it as PFAS. So that's a problem for some people even till today. But by using these transition ions where we atomize and then we ionize and then we break the molecule and then we break it again, so we're looking at the daughter products of the daughter products, and we get very, very unique identification. So with that method, we had samples from all over the world. And so I told the students, why don't we look in these samples and see what we find? We weren't looking for anything in particular. We just wanted to inject it into the machine and see what we got. So when you do mass spectrometry, especially when you're using transition ions, you get lots and lots of data, tens of thousands of data points. So we were playing around with this, and my students found a huge peak in eagle blood. And the peak was much larger than DDT, actually parapara DDE. It was much higher than the PCBs and the usual things that we look at. So we'd been running a monitoring program in the northern United States and southern Canada. So I had thousands of eagle blood samples from very remote areas and also from more urban areas. And we found this huge peak. And that peak turned out to be PFAS. So here's the timeline of sort of what happened. 1952, the PFCs were first synthesized and used. In 1968, actually a dentist at the University of Rochester found fluorine in human blood, organofluorines. He didn't know what it was. Why do you think a dentist was looking for organofluorines in human blood? Anybody know? What were we doing? Still doing? Fluoridating. Okay? It was learned that if you add fluoride to drinking water, you can harden the enamel on teeth, reduce cavities, and that was a good thing. But dentists were concerned that this might result in some organic molecules that could possibly have some toxicity. So they found these in 1968, didn't know what they were. Actually, in 1976, someone identified PFAS in human blood. Now, they didn't have the techniques that we have today, so they couldn't be sure. But he actually postulated that it was PFOS, which I think is remarkable, considering the instrumentation that they had in 1976 and the fact that he was a dentist. So pretty amazing. But 3M was trying to develop methods to measure. They really didn't have good ways to measure, but they were monitoring the health of their workers, and they knew they were exposed to these products, but they didn't see anything unusual. So they thought, everything's fine. In the early 1990s, 3M started to use some other mass spectrometry, but their detection limit was only a half a milligram per liter. Okay, so very, very poor techniques. Because 3M's headquarters is in Minneapolis, actually in St. Paul, they were working with scientists at the University of Minnesota, and they had found some potential linkages with cancer in rodents. So it was starting to develop the idea that there might be some toxicity. So Minnesota looked into this, and they didn't find really any indication in the workers. So still, everybody thought everything was fine. So we got involved in 1997. That's when we got our new unit mass spectrometer, and we identified the compound. We looked in the patent literature to see what it might be, came up with PFAS, and came up with 3M as the sole manufacturer of that chemical. And so I wrote a letter to 3M and said, I think I found your chemical in eagle blood. And about that time, I didn't hear anything for a long, long time from them. And then they wrote back and said, that's clearly impossible. There are no methods to measure this chemical. We've tried. Our chemists are not able to do it. Clearly, you're wrong. Please send us some of your sample, which we did. And then they started making measurements, and they found some organofluorine in blood samples from humans, food blood bank samples. They weren't sure what it was yet, but at that point they said, we might want to move away from this chemistry. So in 1997, we'll just skip over to February of 2000. So between 1997 and 2000, I had kind of a rocky relationship with 3M. They wanted to kind of keep an eye on me, and they actually hired one of my students, Bob Hoke, to follow me around at meetings to see what I was saying. And seriously, but he wasn't allowed to eat with me or talk to me while we were at the meetings, which was bizarre. But anyway, during this time period, then I didn't hear much from them, and we didn't really do much more with this until I got a phone call, and the person said, the CEO of 3M would like to meet you. And I said, okay. And I remember talking to one of my students, Lisa Williams, and I said, boy, I've really stepped in at this time. And they said, we'll come to your house and meet with you. We don't want to come to the university. We'd like to meet you at your house. So three identical white rental cars pulled up with three identical white guys in each car, dressed in identical three-piece blue suits, and they proceeded to come into my house. And my wife was like, what is this all about? And I was like, should I make cookies for them or something, I think she said. Anyway, so they talked to me, and the CEO said, a guy by the name of Desi Desimone, who's really the hero in this story, I think, said to me, he says, you think you found our chemicals in eagle blood? And I said, that's right. And subsequently, we think we found it in polar bear livers and a lot of other things. And he said, well, our scientists think you're right. And we'd like you to work with us to try to answer some questions. Is it in the environment? If so, how much and where? And said, how much would it cost to do some studies? And I, being a university professor, immediately thought, two students and a postdoc. Okay, I said, maybe $100,000, maybe? And he said, well, I came here authorized to give you $3.5 million. And we wrote an agreement, which was between the university and 3M, that basically said it was an unconditional award to the university where 3M really couldn't dictate what we did. And I said, I'd like to not only work on the chemistry and the monitoring, but we'd like to work on the toxicology. And they said, that's fine. The only limitation we had placed on us was 3M said, please don't release anything to the press or publish any papers until you, what do you think they said? Share it with us? Send it to our attorneys? No. They said, until you share it with the US EPA. Don't blindside the US EPA. And I said, okay, we can do that. So we hit, armed with this grant, and they also said, if there's any equipment you need, here's Dale Bacon, the head of our environmental division. You just tell him what you need, and it will be provided. So I became an advisor to them, and like I said, within that first year, we, as I'll show you in a minute, worked out the mode, critical mode of action, developed a little bioassay of toxicity that we could use, and we developed our analytical techniques further, and we did a global survey. I'll show you the results in a minute, and then we did a risk assessment. So in September of 2001, we published our first results in environmental science and technology. I was talking with some of the students this morning. We sent it to science. They rejected it within minutes and said, we don't publish papers on PCBs. But it turns out it's now the most cited paper ever published in ES&T. And as I was looking these numbers up, I noticed that in my top five papers, Keith Solomon's an author on two of them. That are right in this same range. So the paper that science didn't care to have has caused a lot of subsequent publication. So based on this, so right around this time was when I made a presentation to the technical group at 3M over about 2 hours. They said, you need to come back in 2 weeks, give the same presentation but in 20 minutes for the board. Which I did, and at that time, the CEO of 3M stood up and said, Professor, I don't understand. You're telling us you found our chemical in polar bears? How does it get into polar bears? I said, well, it's in the seals that the polar bears eat. Oh, how's it get in the seals? It's in the fish that the seals eat. Oh, and at that point, he paused, and he turned around to the board, and he says, our chemicals shouldn't be in polar bears. And at that point, we'd been doing the toxicology studies and we'd done some preliminary calculations, and we were right at the threshold. And in fact, a colleague at the US EPA in Atlanta was starting to do tests with mice. And what he found was the dose response looked like no effect, no effect, no effect, everybody's dead. It wasn't you get sick, it wasn't you get cancer, it wasn't you feel ill, it was all the kids were dead. And based on that information, we calculated some ratios and we were right close to the threshold. And I will tell you, EPA was scared, absolutely scared. But at the same time, remember, these chemicals are required to make microchips. And I was getting phone calls from congressional representatives, staffers in congressmen's office saying, what are you trying to do? Destroy the entire economy? I did my best, but I had to ultimately rely on the bankers in 2008 to finish the job. I'm just a chemist. What could I do? So in January of 2006, Environment Canada, and at this point, Professor Solomon was getting involved in this research because he'd been seeing our papers at a meeting we had every year here in Guelph with the students. And then Derek Muir at Environment Canada got involved. Scott Mayberry, a very excellent environmental chemist at UT, got involved. So there was a huge Canadian effort. And of course, Environment Canada was hearing about this and knowing about this. And in 2006, they put 87 chemicals that will degrade to PFAS on the list of chemicals scheduled for virtual elimination. In 2009, then, Canada passed the perfluorooctane sulfonate virtual elimination act, which meant it was illegal to manufacture, import, or use perfluorochemicals in any products in Canada, which resulted in a lot of changes. So one of the things we had to do was monitoring. So we wanted to see where it was in the environment. Is it a problem or not? Starts with dose. If there's no exposure, there's no risk. So that was the first thing to look at. So armed with our new techniques, we wanted to get this baseline to determine if there were control measures, how effective would they be. So things like PCBs have been phased out globally for a long, long, long time, but we still find them in the environment at fairly high concentrations. So we wanted to get this background baseline. It had already been decided we're going to phase out this chemistry globally. So we wanted to get the exposure data also for a risk assessment. We wanted to elucidate current global distribution, find out where it's gone over the 50 years that it had been manufactured. And we wanted to look at bioaccumulation and biomagnification by looking at different food chains. So we got samples of algae and fish of different trophic levels, birds, from all over the world. Either we had in our archive or I was able to secure from colleagues all around the world. So all those samples were flowing in. In that first year, we analyzed 2,700 samples to try to answer these questions. So these were the big questions, the environmental distribution and this environmental behavior. Where is it and how does it get there? So here's just a little bit of data. Here's the original bird that we looked at. We looked at blood from our monitoring program. And all the eagles that we found in the Midwestern United States and Canada were all less than 60 days old, which meant they had to be exposed right there. They weren't migrating around. And we found concentrations that range from 2 to 2,500 nanograms per liter with an average of 382. So every eagle sample that we looked at, we found PFAS. And then we did a whole bunch of sampling around the world. And everywhere we looked, we found PFAS. So what I give you here are just some of the animals that we looked at and some of the different locations. We looked at brain, kidney, liver, blood, eggs, muscle, testes, all sorts of different things in different. And these are the sample sizes that we have for those over here. And the detection frequencies are over here. So frogs and turtles, sort of at the bottom of the food chain, not very much. But in mink, for instance, it was 100% everyone. And these are the sample sizes that we had. So we had a lot of samples, and we were seeing this pretty much everywhere we looked. Here's some ring seal from the Canadian Arctic, around 3 to 12 gray seals. I put these in mostly so you can see pretty pictures of animals. Polar bears, this is the one that got the CEO of 3M so excited because he couldn't understand it. And we were finding pretty high concentrations in the liver of polar bears. Other aquatic mammals, river otter, mink, and our positive hits for PFAS was 100%, every sample we looked at. And we found some really big concentrations. So this was a concern. And when we looked at this relative to some of the basic toxic information we had, there was concern. Same thing with birds, things like herons, cormorants, lots and lots of samples. One of my projects has been long-term monitoring of colonial fish-eating water birds. And in fact, here in Canada, we have the herring gull archive, where every year samples of herring gull are taken on a five-year rotation of five major locations around the Great Lakes. So working with Rob Letcher at Environment Canada, we've been able to continue the monitoring to see what's happened since the phase-out. So cormorants, albatross in the middle of the Pacific Ocean on Midway Island, halfway between San Francisco and Tokyo. No industry. This means it was getting out to very, very remote locations. Albatrosses feed on fish and squid in the ocean, the open ocean. And what this told us was this is a global problem. The globe is contaminated with PFAS. There's no place you can go and not find it. Fish, same thing. This is a human dietary issue now. So it's ubiquitous in the environment. It bioaccumulates in humans and wildlife. And the toxic effects at the time were unknown. We had some limited laboratory studies showing some potential developmental and reproductive effects in rats. That was the EPA study. But it was a very quickly done, very crude study. So the next task was to try to figure out what the toxicity is. When you don't know the mechanism of action, it's difficult to determine. So at the time, we were developing what we call DNA microarrays, which means it's DNA on a chip, sort of like salsa on a chip. This is DNA. The different colors mean if it's green, the concentration went up. If it's red, the concentration or the activity went down. And if it's yellow, it stayed the same. So armed with this technology that was very, very new then, very obsolete now, we were able to figure out some of the pathways. We do that by looking at things like a gene tree. So we can look at all these genes, and through a long process of looking at patterns, we can figure out where the key locations in metabolic pathways are occurring. And everything that we looked at was pointing to it was effects on fatty acid metabolism. And because, I told you, they're an analog to a fatty acid, but they cannot be degraded. So when they enter into the metabolism, they end up blocking that pathway, and the response of the organism is to make more of the gene product for that enzyme that they're trying to use to break down the chemical. So we see these upregulations. So we were able to look into that and found that PFAS alters expression of peroxisomal but not mitochondrial fatty acid metabolism. Based on this information, we developed some bioassays, and we know that membranes can be affected by fatty acids. So we developed a quick bioassay based on what we call GJAC, which is gap junction intercellular communication. And we were able to use that assay. And the key point here is I could use that assay to screen for replacement products, because this was a multi-billion dollar industry. And 3M was not particularly interested in walking away from all the products that included this chemistry. And at one point, they were paying me as a consultant to tell them what to do. I wrote a report, and I went up to Minneapolis to present the report. And at the break, at lunch, we were going to go out to a restaurant for lunch. One of the people said, "You can ride with me, Dr. Giese." We got in his car. We hadn't driven a block, and he stopped the car, put it in park, and turned to me and says, "We don't like your report, and we want you to take it back." And I said, "Sorry, no can do." And they put me on a plane and sent me home that day, right then. They said, "Thank you very much. I don't think we'll be needing your help anymore." A little time after that, cooler heads, I guess, prevailed. And the other hero in this story is a guy by the name of Dale Bacon, who's now retired. He was the head of the environmental group, and he knew they had a problem. And he wouldn't let go of it. And it was like Deep Throat. He would call me up and say, "John, I'm flying to Lansing. I'll meet you." He'd come to my house, and he'd say, "Let's talk outside." We'd go outside where he think maybe I couldn't be recording him or something. And he would say, you know, you might want to look at this. And he was doing the same thing here in Canada. And Professor Solomon got involved because he was flying up here and meeting with people and saying, you know, you might want to look at this and things. So giving people sort of hints. And then things sort of, you know, went back to a good working relationship with 3M. The fellow who pulled over was fired. The guy that pulled me over and said, we don't like your report, was let go. Because that was really inappropriate. But anyway, with membranes, one of the things we found was that this chemical is very potent at blocking these gap junctions that allow cells to communicate. So in the cell, small ions move back and forth, and small molecules. And in fact, this is the way cells, in part, protect themselves. And if this cell, for instance, became cancerous, this cell would likely kill it. And what PFAS does is it blocks these gap junction cell-cell communications. Very, very, these are the most potent inhibitors, and that makes them cancer promoters. They're not cancer-causing. They don't initiate cancer. But you're being initiated as you sit there right now, based on basically radiation from space. We're being initiated all the time. But we have a very effective repair mechanism. What this chemical does is block the body's ability to repair the damage. And that's a problem. Because we're all being initiated all the time, the real issues in the environment, at least for me, are promoters. Anything that will promote those cancer cells that are being initiated all the time being transformed into a tumor. So this was a big issue, a big problem. And it results in a lot of developmental problems with these chemicals. So what we were able to do with this is run these bioassays, and what we found was those with a carbon chain of 7 to 10 caused significant inhibition, but those with 6 or less did not. So what we were able to do was suggest to 3M if they changed from PFOS, perfluorooctane sulfonate, to perfluorobutane, 4-carbon sulfonate, they wouldn't have a problem. So they were able to make the change. PFBS is not as effective as PFOS in any of, but it's pretty good. It's pretty close. So they had a replacement that made the decision to walk away from this chemistry very, very easy. And they did that. And they did it without telling other companies. And it turned out some of those other companies hate me to this day because they said, why didn't you come tell us? And I'm like, well, why would I? You know, you weren't funding our research. And so 3M really had an advantage because they knew the path forward. In one meeting, I told them this, and one of the guys from one of the technical people from one of the divisions says, it won't work. It won't work. And the CEO just said, have you tried it? And he says, well, no, but it won't work. I know it won't work. And he just said, try it. They did. And it works. So you can still buy ScotchGard. Doesn't have PFAS in it anymore. You can still buy firefighting foams, lots of other really good products, and you can still buy cell phones and computers, which is handy, because we could make a substitution. Now, PFBS is not perfect. It still doesn't degrade in the environment. It's still persistent. But it doesn't bioaccumulate very much, and what does is basically non-toxic. You have to, even with saturated solutions, we're unable to see any toxic effects. So it is pretty benign. So this was sort of an experiment with some different chemicals, different lengths. So here's the C4, C6, C8. And this, I just have some graphic pictures to show you how this assay works. It's a very quick assay. But we take some cells and we treat them with our chemical. We put in some dye that can't get into the cell, can't cross the cell membrane. Then we break some cell membranes with a blade by cutting across the cells. And then we wash off the fluorescent dye, look at it under a microscope, record the data. And we can tell then if the material, so here's that scratch I told you about. And if the chemical can now get into the cell, it can move through the intercellular passages. So it can't go into these cells up here, but if it gets into this cell, it can move to the other ones. So the distance that it can move in a set time is an indicator of how much inhibition we have. So you can see here, exposed, we did time series, we did concentrations, and up here are cells, when we expose them to 160 micromolar, it completely inhibits cell-cell communication. There's no movement at all. So that was all pretty good. The EPA thought that was great. They liked it. But they said, but it's not real. It's not in an animal. So that we exposed some rats. In vivo, we exposed the rats in vivo, then we took the tissues out, did the experiment similarly, but got the results. So here's the tissue. This is a liver of a rat. Here's the migration of the dye here, and this is the inhibition of the migration of the dye. So it inhibits gap junction cell-cell communication in a dose-dependent fashion. Its chain length, we came up with a predictive model for chain length. It's not affected between long chain and branch chain, to speak of. And so this is a reversible, very rapid response. And some other things we did along the way that weren't easy to do was determine how much it binds to protein in the blood. And here the problem was we had to get PFAS and protein down a mass spectrometer into a detector. And in our group, my colleague Paul Jones spent a year working this out and was eventually able to do this. So then we were able to determine the binding capacity to albumin in the blood. And what we learned was that PFAS is like a yo-yo. Normally, your body metabolizes with phase one enzymes and then excretes or conjugates and excretes. These things can't be metabolized, so there's no phase one enzyme. And secondly, then, they act like bile. I told you there was a bile acid that has the same mass as this molecule, and it has a lot of the same properties. And what happens is your body recycles bile. You use it over because it's a valuable commodity. PFAS acts just like bile. So it's like a yo-yo. Your body tries to get rid of it, and it just reabsorbs it. So it's really hard for you to get rid of it. So the half-life in humans is about 8 years. So in 8 years, you'll get rid of half of what you have in your body now. But we had to work all this out, and it was not particularly easy to do. But we did work out the binding pockets on albumin and where it binds. And it binds one per one, one molecule of PFAS per molecule of serum albumin. I'm going to skip a couple of these slides and just get to the very last thing I want to mention. Is since we had found PFAS in environmental samples, we wanted to determine what the risk was. So we did this for a lot of different things, including people. But the thing I just want to mention is what we did with birds. So we used some model species, the quail and the mallard, and we got information on doses based on a lot of things, how much they ate, how much was in the body, how much was in the serum, how much was in the liver, and got these no effect levels and low effect levels. And then we were able to compare that to concentrations that we were finding in the environment. So there's quite a bit to this. I'm going to skip over on coming up with what we call toxicity reference doses, where we have to predict how much we'll get in the animal and what the effect would be. So I'm going to just get to the result of that, which is here. So these are all the data that we have. This is a frequency histogram of concentrations, and this is our toxicity reference value that we determined through that process. And what you can see here, at that time, some birds were exceeding that threshold. So we had lots and lots of different species from many, many different places. And again, when we looked at the liver, same thing, we had exceedances. And when we looked in plasma, again, we had exceedances. So we definitely had a problem in birds. We looked at water concentrations, corrected for accumulation into the bird, and again, we saw that we were exceeding it. So the last thing I want to mention is what's the current status and where are we going? We've been looking at dated sediment cores from the Great Lakes. This happens to be from Lake Michigan, which is the closest one to the 3M company that's here. And the key bottom line is that concentrations of PFAS started to decrease almost immediately after the phase-out. So the good news is the concentrations are going down. We dodged the bullet. We avoided a global catastrophe like things with DDT happened. So we got right to the brink, I guess. And so it would be hard to show that we actually had effects in birds, but we were probably very close. This is the situation in an industrialized area of Korea with one of my Korean students. We made measurements. We found huge concentrations. We reported this to the Korean government, and they stopped the inputs. And now it's going down. So that's a good thing. Get over that. So we did well. We dodged the bullet. We got lucky, I guess. We found replacements. We were able to continue having the products we want and got the bad actor out of the environment. PFAS has now been on the Stockholm Convention Appendix B, which is scheduled for virtual elimination. As I told you, 87 individual PFC chemicals are now banned in Canada, but they're still made in China. And in fact, China has taken up the slack, and now I'm focused in on them. We're doing monitoring around the producing areas and working with the central government, State Environmental Protection Agency, and that will be stopped in the near term. So things are good. So here's the law. I'm not going to read it all to you, but this is the first announcement in 2006 in the Canada Gazette by Environment Canada that this was a problem and that they were going to start phasing out PFAS. Canada was one of the first countries in the world. Canada and Japan were the two leaders, even ahead of some of the U.S. The U.S. banned a few specific chemicals. Canada got the whole group that would degrade to that chemical. So US EPA acted first. They sent letters to every government in the world saying, we suggest you get out of this chemistry. But Canada was one of the first to do a really detailed assessment and then actually, as early as 2006, start to phase this out. And then finally, in 2009, they promulgated the legislation that basically makes it illegal to use these chemicals. Now, it's virtual elimination because it's still in products that are out in use. So you can't just eliminate it all right now, but the idea is we won't introduce anymore. So we found the replacements, moved ahead, and hopefully it was an interesting story. You know, some lessons to be learned, I guess. This was purely serendipitous. We were not looking for this chemical. I told you chemists find what they look for. If you tell me, John, how much PFAS is in this bird egg, I can do that. If you come to me with a bird egg and say, what stuff is in this bird egg, it's a whole lot different question. So to sort of pick this chemical out was not an easy thing to do. And then once we published our papers, people around the world were trying to reproduce things and having all sorts of problems. People were emailing me saying your method doesn't work. A lot of people had problems with this bile fatty acid in the blood of humans, and there you'll find a lot of wrong answers in the literature. So it wasn't an easy chemistry problem to solve. But being given the freedom by 3M to also look at the toxicity at the end of the day was their saving grace, because we were able to provide them an alternative. And had they not done that, they said, nope, you're just a chemistry guy, leave it to us to look at effects, we might not have done that. So it might have been a whole different story. So it was serendipitous. We had the freedom and flexibility to follow it up. I had the inquisitiveness to say, wonder what the heck it is, and is it a problem? And now we're applying those same kind of techniques in the oil sands. My most recent task from the minister was to come up with a way to monitor for effects of oil sands process-affected water that has 250,000 chemicals in it. And the bottom line is, I just got the results from Garrett, one of my students. We have a predictive model, and I can, with my new ultra-high-resolution mass spectrometer, without ever naming all the chemicals, I have a model that's accurate within 2% of what we measure, and I can predict it. So very quickly, we can inject the sample into the mass spectrometer. We get the data out. It goes straight into the model. I don't know what the structure is. I don't know what the name of it is, but I can predict for you the aquatic toxicity. So we were able to solve that problem as well. So anyway, thank you for letting me be here again. It's always great to come back to Guelph and see all my friends. And any questions?
We have time for questions.
Comments?
I'll start at the back. Yes, please.
What's the half-life time or residence time in the human?
About 8 years.
That's in human.
Hmm?
I thought that was in the environment.
No, in people. In the environment, it is forever. The only loss route from the environment is burial in the deep sediments. Yeah, probably not, but I'm not sure. Probably not, because most of the effects seem to be reversible. It's a physical phenomenon in the membranes, and it's completely reversible. So if we remove the exposure, we wash it back out, the effect goes away. So it's not a permanent effect. It's not causing DNA damage directly. It's not causing free radical singlet oxygen effects. It seems to be a physical phenomenon. The reason we got the dose response that we get, where no effect, no effect, no effect, everyone's dead, is it binds to albumin in the blood. And as soon as you've saturated those sites, it's free to wreak havoc, and that's where you see developmental effects and you see embryo lethality. It seems to be a physical process. It can't really make covalent bonds.
Gordon had a question. Oh, and Benjo.
Thank you for the excellent talk. I can see from your gap junction data that this chemical definitely has an effect on reducing communication between cells, but is there any evidence that it is actually a cancer promoter, either experimental or through occupational exposure?
Yeah. One of the things that occurred that was pretty interesting is a number of my former students work for US EPA, Environment Canada, and they got very excited and wanted to follow this up. What happened in the United States was there was no further research funded because this was a huge embarrassment. The US EPA had told Congress, you'll never, ever have another DDT. We test everything. We understand everything. When this one popped up, it was a huge embarrassment. And what happened was they wanted to just say, problem solved, we banned it, let's just move on. Within EPA, nobody was allowed to follow up, because one of the obvious questions was to do some studies to see. Nobody at that time had done that. And now it's very hard to get any funding to study these chemicals. It's problem solved, we move on. Environment Canada is not doing any more research. So there are a lot of studies that could be done, probably should be done, but have not been done. And that would certainly be one of them.
I think Joe had a question.
Yeah. I have a curiosity. Are there any specific correlation between when the chemical, the PFOS, was manufactured or synthesized and then being used, and also in global increase in cancer cases?
Oh.
And then after, you know, they've changed to the C4 compound, are there any kind of a decrease or whatever?
Yeah, I think, Joe, that would be almost impossible to sort out with all the other things that were happening at the same time. Even when you do controlled epidemiological studies, which now have been done for PFOS and PFOA, people have gone back. There are about 25 studies. They're equally divided. Some show associations and other ones not. So depending on the endpoint, one is cancer that people look at, people have looked at reproductive effects, fertility, all these things. Sometimes there's an association, it's generally very weak, and sometimes there is not. One of the things that I've not published, which I'll share with you, but I haven't published it because I'm not sure I have all the data. But long story short, we see one of the effects of these chemicals are on development. You see a lot of abnormalities because in early development, you have to have this cell-cell communication for tissues to develop properly. If you block that, you get all kinds of deformities. One that we have found repeatedly is neural tube closure. And we've seen that in... we've seen an association in samples from the field. Now we've done a rat study, and we've seen it in rats. And now what we've just finished in the last few weeks is the mechanism. We weren't sure of the mechanism. Now I know the mechanism, and so we're going to submit it to PNAS. But we've been sitting on it for 4 years because I wasn't sure. But in that case, that could be a fairly severe effect. But we did see it, an association in China. So we have a big sample of human samples, and we were able to do a case-control study, and it's a very strong association with PFOA. So not a lot of epidemiology is done, and when it is, it's pretty ambiguous, difficult.
One other question. This is just a naive question. Is knowing what you know, and it's seeing that even eagle and polar bear are getting PFOS, what would be safe for us to eat? Like, what would be your grocery list?
Yeah, well, good question. I guess, first of all, I think this is probably not the last chemical environmental surprise we're going to get. But I'm an old guy. I still pretty much eat to survive. And I don't really worry about it too much. But yeah, there are lots of things that are potential concerns, and they're not all artificial. So, yeah, dietary exposure to lots of things is a concern. We've been working on a site in China. It's not all dietary, different exposures. But long story short, we provide raw materials. They make electronics, send them to us. We use them till they're obsolete and send them back. And in China, they're doing e-waste recycling. And there's a city that where I'm working currently where 27% of birth outcomes were either a stillbirth or a visible deformity. Imagine if that happened here in Guelph. The government would fall. Okay? That's happening for real in China. Now, it's not these chemicals. It's other things. Mercury, lead, a lot of brominated flame retardants and things. But it's a real demonstrated effect where people are being affected by their diet. You know, in Canada, in general, I think our diet's pretty safe. Concentrations are pretty low. We've been looking in the sediment to see what's happening, and literally as soon as this was phased out, the concentrations in the sediment started to go back down very, very quickly. That indicated to us that the primary source to the environment was during manufacturing, okay, because that's the quickest thing to, as soon as you stop manufacture. It's still coming out of carpets to this day. So if that was the major source, it probably would be more of a hysteresis effect, slower. But it's coming down pretty fast. And Rob Letcher is seeing it in polar bears in the Arctic now and the monitoring that he's been doing. It's significantly less and going right on down. So that's good. But, yeah, is it a problem in human food? My best guess is no. The risk assessment that we've done, the margin of safety is at least 100 with the most conservative assumptions and probably more like 1,000 or 10,000. So it's pretty low.
We have time for one more question. Maybe somebody is.
Good question. The concentrations we found in the eagles, we calculated back how much would be there if all that was in the egg that we were measuring was diluted. It's called growth dilution in animals. So if you start with just that, and the bottom line was it wouldn't have accounted for very much. most of what they were exposed to was from their diet, and it had to be local because they were 60 days old or less. They can't fly. They can't go anywhere. So they were being exposed through the diet. But the egg is interesting because what does PFOS bind to? Protein, right? Albumin, which eggs. So, yeah, so it is transferred from the mother or the female to the egg, and it can cause deformities in fish, in birds, a lot of other things. So there is that maternal exposure, and it can be an effect. Multi-generational, if you stopped the exposure, I think there wouldn't be enough carryover to result in long-term multi-generational effects. We've not seen any epigenetic effects. One of my colleagues, Jim Trosko at Michigan State, got very interested in these chemicals and has been following up, and he and Brad Upham have been publishing papers. And his field is epigenetics, and as far as I know, they have not yet found any epigenetic effects.
You're telling me we have a little bit more time, so we can take another question. Yeah, you have an appointment at 2, but we have a bit of time. We'll take 2 more questions. Sorry. First at the back, and then...
Gladys already had a question.
John, there was the TSCA regs are being and policies are being revised currently, and I wondered if you knew anything about the whether or not the Polymer Exclusion Act will be retained.
I don't think so, Gladys. Okay. I think that one's history. Yeah, no, I cannot overstate how shocked EPA was. I mean, I was in a meeting with EPA because 3M said, okay, now you've told us, you need to go down and tell the EPA. They didn't say, we're going to tell the EPA. They said, you need to tell the EPA. And people's faces were literally white. I mean, when they saw the data, they went, oh, my God, how do we reverse this? And they basically, jointly with 3M, decided to withdraw the product effective the end of that year, immediately. A lot of companies were upset because 3M just said, we're not going to make it anymore. And they said, but you have to provide it. It's critical to our process. And they said, not our problem. You know, we're not going to make it anymore. So that was a very courageous decision. And I think it worked out well because of the way I worked with them. I never threatened them in the newspaper and tried to make them look bad. I tried to get behind the board doors and say, listen, people, this is what's going on. And when you do that, you're educating and not really criticizing. And they responded, I thought, very, very responsibly. You know, 3M was shocked, absolutely shocked. They think of themselves as a very, very green company. And they were absolutely shocked and chagrined when this came up. And they definitely wanted to do the right thing. But yeah, the polymer exclusion clause was corrected instantaneously by EPA with a policy amendment. You can find it in plants. I've not spent a lot of time looking at plants, but other people have. There's, I think, about 27,000 papers in the literature now on PFAS, and some of them give measurements in plants. One of the issues was in biosolids, so wherever you're using biosolids on ag land, this was one of the chemicals that was of concern. But generally, it's not the driving force for the risk assessment. Generally, metals far outstrip the risk to plants. But interestingly, before all this happened, 3M was selling wastes from their wastewater treatment plant to a farmer who was putting it on his land where he was growing corn. And one of the things we did early on was measure it, and we do find it in the corn. It is accumulated. But the concentrations are not much greater than what they are in the soil.
Quick answer, so we could squeeze one more in.
You mentioned you have a model that allows you very quickly to get What's the basis of that?
It's polar narcosis is the mechanism that we assume for the chemicals. With the mass spectrometer, I can get an accurate mass. And I've done a study, I don't have time to explain it all, but we've actually got bioaccumulation factors for every one of the chemicals that occurs. Once again, I haven't tried to put a structure on every one, But I can identify what it is. This is chemical 62. And I can measure it in the water and in the tissue of animals, and also in something we call twisters, which is PDMS, polydimethyl siloxane. And then we can predict the bioaccumulation factor from that model. Once I know how much is going to get into the animal, I'm using, at this point, a fathead minnow quantitative structure activity relationship based on polar narcosis is the endpoint. It works well for acute toxicity. Now, I don't know how well we're going to do for chronic. We're starting those studies right now. But it's going to be harder. Yep, all good questions. Thank you all very much.
I'd just like to thank Dr. Giese once again and the Royal Society of Canada for hosting this. And I would like to present you, John, with a token of our appreciation. I understand from a beer, their books, and one of the books is by a UG author. I'm not sure which one. I haven't looked inside your package yet. But thank you very much once again. Thank you.